Good morning.
Is that good back there? Too loud? Good? Okay. So first off, you'll notice I'm not at my laptop. I'm not at my laptop because I do not want to show you code today. I want to talk today. So that's the plan for this lecture and the next lecture, as I'm mostly going to be talking. I'll be taking some notes. I'll put them directly into the wiki. If you are responsible for doing notes for this class, whatever I put in the wiki will really just be the bare points, and there's a lot more that I'll be saying, so if you can expand whatever I put in the wiki, I'll appreciate it. So first off, logistics. As I sent out a message yesterday, if you misunderstood on assignment 9 that you were only supposed to give snippets of the transcript from SOCAD as opposed to giving all of it, you may resubmit. That is no problem. You can resubmit through Friday. Again, the solutions for that, I mean, I will put up solutions for that this weekend, but I mean, really the point of that assignment really is the exercise of doing it. If looking at the solutions will not get you much, except to help you verify that you're actually understanding things correctly. But if you, yes? Mm-hmm. Yes, it's from the get to the entire request, and you return the entire response.
Yeah.
Now, some people were having really large transcripts because they were also including the gets for jQuery. And jQuery is kind of large. So, I mean, really, it's not that large in terms of modern network speeds and everything like that, but in terms of something that you hand in, printed and stuff, yeah, it's kind of big. So you don't do that. But you shouldn't be doing that because the request and response, I mean, you should just be for that particular get request. I mean, if every particular get and post can potentially cause other gets and posts, the thing I'm asking you to do is isolate it. So if you look at the assignment, you'll notice I specifically asked for get of slash, JavaScript notes, get notes, update notes, new note. That's all stuff that's our code. These all produce relatively small responses. Mm-hmm.
So get/prompts.
Yeah, well, get slash generates many other gets, but those are separate. Those are all separate requests. I mean, I want really, if you go into the network view, and you see what's the get and what's the response for that particular get, that's what I want, but extracted from SOCAD. So you want to resubmit, go ahead. Assignment 10 is due Monday, but I will accept it through the review session, which means us to saying, when is the review session? So I was thinking the review session should be on, let's make it a little bigger, on next Friday, the 10th. So we are here at the 1st. Our last class is on the 6th. Our exam, I think, is on the 14th. So I was going to put the review session on the 10th. I could do a review session on the 13th, but that seems a bit too close. And I have an exam on that 13th afternoon anyway. So, but I can do it on the 10th. Does that sound good? I was thinking like 1 p.m. Hmm? I will tell you which room. I have to reserve it. I have to book it once I've done this, and I'll use the ad hoc booking. So I was thinking, yes? At 2? I have 1, 2, it doesn't really matter to me. Any objections to 2 o'clock? Well, let's say 2 o'clock right now. And I'll post a message in the announcements, and if anyone has an objection, we can discuss again on Monday. But for now, we will say, go ahead and change this while I'm here. We'll say April 10. Ooh, does this change languages? Oh, yeah, it does, but not in a useful way. Okay, so April 10. 2:00 PM. Room TA. And so in the review session, my plan is to go through the solutions for the last assignment. Again, I think the solutions for the last assignment should be, it's more the exercise of doing it as opposed to solutions being that useful, because it's just bugs in it. And you know, if you can debug it, think of this as a check. If you can debug it reasonably well, you're in good shape. If you're having significant troubles doing the debugging, that means you're missing, you know, pieces, and you should, you know, work with someone to try doing that. So if you work in a group on the last assignment, you may be losing parts of it. So just keep that in mind. Also notice there's some issues on assignment 7 with, I'm going to also post a message about this, about some of the code from some people looking rather similar, and they didn't actually put in any collaboration note. That's why you have the comments.txt to say who you work with. So if your code looks kind of similar, we can kind of say okay. But Lucas noticed some of that. So I'm going to give you a little amnesty here. Like, if you tell me by Friday that you did some collaboration and, you know, you didn't put it in your assignment and tell us, then it's all good. But please tell us. I don't want to be having to do something at the end of the semester talking to the dean about people not being particularly intellectually honest. Because I'm saying you can work together, but you just have to tell us. So I think that's that. Anything else? Did everyone see Google's April Fool's thing? Smart box. It's a mailbox that has it's a mail organizer for real mail. It's yeah, kind of cute. Anyway. That's another. Yeah, that's an Easter egg, Pac-Man on some Google Street Maps. Yeah. Anyway, sorry, still got a little bit of a cough here. So what the topic is for today is, got my notes here. So what is that better? What are the fundamentals of web applications? So really there's two topics for the last what are the fundamentals and web so this is talking about where all you'll see web applications around the world, but and various things are to come up. But the big one I want to talk about is this. What are the fundamentals of web applications? You know, this class is, that's the title of this class, right? But the way I've structured this course is most of it has been very centered around very practical things. I show you code, we talk about the code, and I talk about the concept necessary for you to understand that code. I haven't been talking in generalities, which is a bit odd for me. Normally I take more of the big picture. So today in the last class, I want to talk more about the big picture and try to put everything in context. This will not specifically be on the final exam because this stuff is much harder to test unless I make you write essays. So that won't be tested, but hopefully this will help you understand what you've been doing and put it into context with the rest of your classes and other stuff you're going to learn. So what are the fundamentals? So key. I'm not sure how to organize this. We'll see. We'll just do it like this. So what would I call some of the fundamentals? I think, first off,
I'm going to list these first, and then we'll go through and talk about them individually. I think one big thing for web for this class was teaching about distributed applications, the fact of applications that don't run on one machine. Now there's a structured persistence, aka databases, but I have a slightly different perspective on that. Talking about front and back end and applications, and just kind of that as a basic idea. Markup and templates. Trust. There's more things. These are the ones. This is today how I'm choosing to structure it. Other things that you all. I'm kind of curious what you all perceive. Any other ones? I'm sure I'll add to this list in a bit, but. That's about undistributed applications. Okay, we'll start with this, and then we may add to it. So let's first talk about what I mean by structured distributed application. So here, applications So when I say distributed applications, I'm talking about applications that run on more than one computer. That means so separate memory, CPU, and now that's what we mean by separate computers. That's what I mean. It's separate memory, separate CPU, separate storage, separate I/O. Now when we talk about separate computers, those computers do not necessarily have to be separate physical computers. In fact, when we talk about this, it can you apply this to processes. Processes, virtual hosts, or physical hosts. They're all, the same issues of separation are there. The only difference is in what sort of links you can have between them and how fast they are, what's the latency, what's the connection. So what's the big deal about these distributed applications? Why is this different from what you've covered elsewhere in your curriculum? I mean, this isn't something that you've generally seen. What makes them weird when you're kind of spreading them apart? I mean, and most of what you've seen is probably in like 2401 you saw some networking, but that was just a small part of the class, and then that wasn't, really talking about the distributed thing. Because, of course, our applications are at least in three pieces nowadays. There's one part that runs in the browser, there's one part that runs in the web server, and there's another part that runs in the database. It's three distinct parts. And of course, it goes up from there, because you could have all kinds of other things, like what happens when you include a Twitter feed in your front end? Then actually you're using the Twitter's, servers in addition to your own, and that's communicating. And maybe you're using a separate authentication service, or there's all kinds of ways that you go to many more machines in order to build your applications.
What's weird to me is how we could both be on the same router. We could both have our own separate local host, and potentially have our own web servers on our own local host on the same router.
So the whole notion of local host seems a bit confusing. It's weird. So the thing to remember about localhost, is a way to, it's a way to treat the same computer as that's really what, you know, why do we have, what's localhost useful for? It's for the computer talking to itself. And so when you want to have multiple processes talk on the same system, and you want to use the same methods that you would use to talk to other computers, you talk to localhost. But everything we've done in this class applies to other hosts. Like if I go to, you know, let's just go to the Google homepage, and let's put up the, you know, development stuff. Let's go to the network, and let's, you know, reload. And you'll notice there's all these things. There's all these gets to here. This is the domain. This domain is just like, instead of localhost, this could have been principal run things, but you've got your request, you've got your client server response. It's all the same stuff. All that changes is the host you're talking to. That's what we've been doing in this class. I mean, everything applies. If you're going to go talk about the biggest web application to something just running on your box, it's all the same protocol. It's all the same bits and pieces. Mm-hmm. Flipboard.
Yeah, where it's just, it basically allows you to sign into multiple social networks and, like, your site and stuff like that, and brings everything to one location.
Oh, awesome.
I just wanted to see if something like that would require a server.
Flipboard is your personal, oh, this? So you're wondering, how does an application like this, like Flipboard, does it work? What servers is it talking to?
Does it have its, like,
Flipboard has its own server. It has to have its own server, because what are you logging into right now? And then when you log in, you're going to pull down, and you might say, when you log in to something like Flipboard, and this is grabbing stuff from all your other accounts. So you're wondering, is it grabbing stuff from your other accounts? Is it all just going to your browser, or is it going through the Flipboard servers? Depends. But in general, it's probably going through their servers in some way, because what they're probably doing is caching it and doing it in the background and accelerating it, and so they have parts of it. I mean, it may be a more of an Ajax type application in the sense they may do pull in a lot of the resources from the browser and be running a lot of code there, but some of it's running on the server. It depends on the architecture. I'd have to like analyze it, what it is. But the one thing about modern web applications is you can combine data from multiple servers in the browser in a lot of flexible ways. But so this is definitely a distributed application, but yeah, the server's doing stuff. In particular, what's being stored at Flipboard is your credentials. They know, in some ways, they may not have the exact way of... Normally when you do the sign up with Facebook or something, or you incorporate, look. So when you sign up with Facebook, they do not get your Facebook password. But they get an authentication token, and Facebook basically says, yes, you are who you say you are. But when you go back to Flipboard, they get access to a lot of your stuff, and they're keeping a lot of state. Because you don't reconfigure it every time you go into it. Anyway, that's kind of a side thing, but that is a good example of a distributed application. Modern web application can pull things from lots of different sources. And you know, all the things when you did a get JSON and when you did a post, the way those work, I mean, and they can go to any server. You can do a post to any server. You know, you just specify the URL. Right? You just fill out the form. You can do a get JSON. It's just a get. And it returns JSON. And then you have data. You can do that to basically anywhere. So that's what makes Ajax applications so flexible, is they can be doing these calls. You know, get and post. Yes, sir.
When we talk about distributed applications, does that mean the application itself is distributed among more than one computer, or are we talking about one different users log in or use that application? This means this is distributed.
What it means is the application is running across multiple computers. And normally, distributed applications are used by multiple users, but not necessarily. It's a separate thing for saying there's multiple users. The distributed application is saying that it's running on multiple computers. And everything that we have done in this class has logically been running across multiple computers. All the computers would have been just separate processes. And those processes were all resident on your computer that you were running. But logically, they didn't have, there's no technical reason they had to be on that computer except to make it convenient. The MongoDB you could have been using could have been one running on my computer. The web client you're using to access your web server could have been running on another computer. You just would have to configure your networking properly so that it's accessible. I mean, some of you in class connected to my web servers when I was connected to DHCP, when I showed you sometimes. I mean, it just works. I mean, there's just a matter of a little configuration, where are you in the network? And that's what you do when you get a domain name, is you're getting a place on the network to label your web server, saying, I'm here. This is what the name of my computer is. But we have been doing distributed applications this entire semester. And so, web So basically, web applications, they're the main form. They're the premier form of distributed applications today. To the point that distributed applications that in principle would not have to involve the web in any way use the web in various ways, in that sense that they use web technologies. They use HTTP as an underlying protocol. They'll use HTML. They'll use CSS. They'll use JavaScript. They'll use all. They'll have a database somewhere. I mean, this is how people build applications. Sometimes they even build like applications on your phone. As this will be talking with everyone, later, have a distributed architecture. Games on your phone even have this kind of web distributed application architecture, even though they're just running on one device that, in principle, is not that powerful. So, that's also the reason why, assignment 9 was about looking at the network traffic. What's the key about about distributed applications? They communicate over networks. That's what you were looking at, the protocol that was connecting the pieces of your application. And this, what's really weird about these sort of things? So we'll talk about this more with trust, but one basic principle of distributed applications is in general you don't control all the computers that your code runs on. I mean, when I say your code, I should really put that in quotes, because you're potentially incorporating code from many different sources. For example, if you're going to build, how do you add, you all know about Google Analytics? So if you've done any sort of general web development and things, you're going to probably incorporate things like Google Analytics, or there's a couple of competitors to it. The idea is that you incorporate a little bit of JavaScript into your web page. You just basically, it's an HTML snippet, but you just stick it in there, and it loads some JavaScript, and then it provides statistics on who is visiting your web page and what they do with your web page. And this all goes back to Google, and then you can go check a dashboard, and you can see all these nice stats, these nice graphs and everything about how people are engaging with your website. It's really easy to add. But when you do that, you're running Google's code. You're running Google's code in a couple of different ways. One is you've incorporated Google's code into your web application. It's running in your web browser. In the web browser, it's running in the context of your pages. So it potentially, Google's code has access to all the data that your web code has, that the client-side JavaScript has. It can do anything that your code can do. There's no difference between it once it's loaded into the JavaScript context. It's one execution environment inside of a web page. And so that code, and then also you're depending upon the code running on Google servers. That's doing the back-end analytics work. So it used to be the code that you would run that wasn't, yet you didn't write, was just like a library that you'd incorporate, or maybe it was like you'd make a call to the operating system and it would run some stuff. But now you're talking to random servers all over the internet to do stuff for your app. That's what makes your app, that's what I'm saying. It's distributed in the full sense. Now, Analytics. Let's just see why Google Analytics. Just want to see if I can find it. Getting started with analytics. Okay, first you do this. Follow the instructions, set up web tracking. Google Tag Manager. I just want to see. So add the Google Analytics tag. The Google Analytics tag is a new version of Google Analytics tracking tag. So instead of using the Analytics tag, you put the Universal Analytics tracking ID into the web property field. This is much more annoying.
Yes? You know how you can, let's say, can you have a page filled with links, filled with information, you put random information on your page, so whenever someone Google searches for anything, mm-hmm. your page would pop up, you understand? And then could mm-hmm. you make it so you have an Ajax call that just wipes clean your website and then passes the actual website over it? So Google finds a website, when they look for your website or they crawl, uh-huh. they'll find a website filled with information on everything, and they'll put your website up there because you've got...
So what you're talking about is, how does a search engine work? The way a search engine works is the Google bots go around crawling the web, indexing everything. It means what they're doing is they're downloading everything they can find, same for the Google servers, then they generate an index, and that's what they use to allow you to search. So can you give the Googlebot different data than what you would give a regular visitor? Oh, yes, because, of course, the Googlebot has its own user agent string. It says it's a Googlebot. And you look at that and you'll say, instead of saying it's Mozilla or something, it'll say it's a Googlebot. And could you have some code in your website that checks whether the Googlebot is visiting versus a regular user visiting and gives them different content? Yes, you definitely can. And if you do those sort of tricks, does Google have ways of checking that? Oh, yes. And when you do stuff like that, what does Google do to you? They downgrade you or remove you from their index. It's called, the Google death sentence. I mean, if you do stuff to mess with Google's search engine, and they decide that you've been doing improper optimization, they will either downgrade or remove you from the index. So it's you got to be careful. All this, anyone who tells you about search engine optimization, be careful. Yes. So just to repeat that, you said when eBay got blacklisted from Google, they lost 30% of their daily traffic. Search engines are big businesses. There's a reason why Google has so much money. They don't make money from doing their funny little ads or something. They make their money from search advertisements and embedded advertisements on other pages. Basically, that's it. So, here's how to embed a video. Click the share link under the video. Click the embed link. Copy the code provided in the expanded box. Paste the code into your blog or website. So, let's go to YouTube. I'm just kind of just showing you what I say about, you know, I just wanted to show you a simple example here. So you go to YouTube. Okay. What's on the front page? Oh, goodness. This is just depressing. Okay, we'll go with Taylor Swift, sure. This plugin is vulnerable and should be updated. Okay. So, share. No, share. So embed. So you see this. This is what you embed. This is what you add to your web page. So it's an iframe tag. So what is an iframe tag? It's basically supposed to be a separate little page. That's, you know, it's essentially a page in a page. That's what it is, HTML tag. We haven't played with iframes. So it's an iframe. You give it a width of this. Give it a height of this. You give it the source. Here's the URL. Says the border on it, no border on the frame tag. Allow full screen, okay, yeah, then close the iframe tag. That's what you do. That's it. Now this is actually a pretty simple, so what they're saying here is that when you incorporate this, you're gonna load a whole nother page inside of that. So that's not going to be embedding. How to embed Google AdSense within posts on WordPress. So, step one, log into your Google AdSense account. Click on My Ads, locate the AdSense we'd like to display at. Needed to save. Log into WordPress, posts, create your post usually. Click on the HTML tab, the top right of the post header. Paste in the AdSense code into the post you want to where the ad to appear. Click Publish. So, to get AdSense, it's just a little bit of HTML. And I've looked at the AdSense code before. Actually, let's go to a, you know, do we have AdSense here? I was kind of curious whether this okay. I just find this really funny. So if we go to a view, inspector, if you look, let's bring this up here. Come on. So, Omniture Pixel. Okay, here is advertising programs. Google image class. This is an image script tag. New Omniture link set. That looks like JavaScript to me. Where'd that come from? Oh, script. Source, scripts, Omniture link plug set. I think that's some code that Omniture, I think that's an ad agent, gave you, so. More JavaScript. Okay, here's some JavaScript. Here's some, Adobe tag, something. I mean, if you're looking at this and just going like, wow, that's a lot of code. Oh, Nielsen tracking. Okay, a Nielsen site census. Right. I mean, it's crazy if you look at the source of modern web pages, how much random HTML and JavaScript, in particular, is being incorporated into the page. I mean, you might have noticed the pages we develop in this class seem to load a lot quicker than some of the pages you visit on the web. Part of that's because it's local, but also a big part of it is because they're not doing nearly as much. I mean, look at how many script tags there are here. This is kind of nuts. And you might say, this is a really bad, bad page, or this is a particularly complicated page. No, this is normal. I mean, let's try to pick one that we might consider kind of like those, cbc.ca. Okay, here's a modern web page. What does this look like? Let's look, so what are they doing? Okay, script. What are we doing here? Okay, there's some get time. Let's see now. They got the, oh, here's the header here. What have they got here? Oh, meta link fav icon script. Text JavaScript. Oh, they've got some. Okay, there's some. Ajax, googleapis.com, Ajax web font. Okay, they're doing web fonts. Google functions. Optimizely.com. That's a funny little bit of JavaScript. Let's just see what that is. I'm just kind of curious what that is, because that just looks kind of optimizely. That just sounds. I mean, it's minified. They've taken all the spaces and stuff, but I mean, I don't know what that's doing. I mean, you've learned all the basics. I mean, you could actually, so what you could do is like, you're wondering, what the heck does this code do? There are programs to de-minimize JavaScript. So you can do that and they will reformat so it looks a little bit nicer and stuff. But still, this is obfuscated code. Even if you do the de-minimization, it will still be a bit of a pain to understand. But it's just JavaScript. I mean, look. Oh, look. There's a method call. There's quotation marks. There's an if. I mean, it's just code. It's just bizarro code. And again, this is code. Look, CBC is incorporating this code from this place. Now, what was I? Now, what is this probably doing? Oh, it's cdn.optimizely.com. So, well, that's our content distribution network. Is there jQuery on here? There's web font on here, but oh, page ads, Google syndication at page ads, show companion ad. Ooh, I wonder if we look at that code. What does that look like? Huh. That's a little funny. Woo! Okay, that's more code. Even more code. So for those of you who are just getting the audio, literally all, if you're wondering how to regenerate what we did in lecture, just go to a random page and look at the source code. A modern web page, look at the source code, look at all the script tag, and you'll just be going like, wow, there's a lot of stuff there going on that I don't understand. Now, you might wonder, are they just being difficult? Why is this code obfuscated? And it's, one thing is minimized, but this is more than minimized, this is obfuscated. Why is all this code obfuscated? It's a basic reason. No. That's why you compress it. That's why you minimize it. Not why you obfuscate it. Well, yes, but why? No. They're making their code more complicated on purpose. Steal it. I just copied it. It's running on my system. But why? Why do they care? It's not like copyright or something. I'm running, they run our code, put it everywhere.
Well, so that you sort of can't like learn how to do it for yourself, like make your own website the same?
Nope. It's not about not incorporating the website yourself. Nothing to do with that. And there's a few, I'll say there's a few special cases where that might be true, but that's almost never true in the real web. If you can understand how it's doing, you can find vulnerabilities. Maybe that's part of it, but motivation. I'm looking for motivation here.
There may be some system that they don't want you to gain, like advertising or something like that.
There we go. That's what it is. So let's go to, what's a good site with lots of ads? Well, that's the CBC site. So we've got this here. Okay, other advertisements. Oh, look, there's the CBC is not so good because they just mostly show their own ads.
Nobody's but on their
Yeah, the $1 million webpage. So you see this website? You see all these ads they have up there? See that right there? Oh, St. Jude's. Okay. So, oh, subscribe to the Houston Chronicle. Okay. Oh, here's an ad that should be there. Here's an ad or something. So here's a question. What happens when I click on this ad? Yes, it redirected that. What else happened? Although this one looks like a... Let's go to... So, I've got here advertisements. Again, I'm surprised at how few advertise. I'm not finding good sites with like crazy numbers of advertisements. Well, let's, oh, there we go. There's a nice advertisement. So, if I click on this, I click on it, I go to the site. What else happened?
I guess the website gets
money because of the... Money! Money, money, money. They clicked on this. New York Times just got a little bit of money. Because they clicked on an ad. Or they got a little bit of money because they displayed the ad to me. I see the ad, thus I get money. Oh, look, maybe they checked that I moused over it. Oh, they moused over it. They kind of paid attention to it. They must have, you know, let's pay them some money. Or they clicked on it. Oh, let's do that. Do you know how to code such things? Can you write JavaScript code to click on a link? Yes. Can you write JavaScript code to, you know, show views? Yes. Could you do JavaScript code to automatically grab this? Yes. Why don't I make a little bot that goes around and makes me money, money, money? I just add an ad to my blog and it just sort of simulates a million people clicking on my blog, visiting the page. There's a term for that. It's called click fraud. In general, the web is funded primarily by advertisements. The advertisements are based on JavaScript code. The JavaScript code is running in untrusted browsers, running potentially on people's machines that actually want to steal money. That's why the code is obfuscated. Because if they can figure out how it works, they can steal money. So, but that's the funding model. So that's why you'll find most of the code in the web is, a lot of it's very highly obfuscated because most of it is either related to tracking directly or the displaying of advertisements. And those two things are how things are monetized. That code tends to be hard to figure out. So don't feel bad if you can't figure it out. You're not supposed to. They don't want you to. But you may want to incorporate it into your website because you want to make money. So since we're talking about this, let me move to trust. So when you run a modern web application, who are you trusting? You're trusting, you know, you have to trust the people who wrote whatever libraries you incorporate. You have to also trust, you know, whoever wrote jQuery or whoever wrote Node. You have to make sure their code is good. But you also have to trust content. The content providers, the ad providers. So whatever else you add to the page, you have to trust all that to work properly. Because what can that code do to you? It's all running JavaScript. It's all running in your environment. Can that code rewrite your page? Yes. So what does trust really mean? Who's going to screw you over? who, if they, if they go bad, how badly are you hurt? If you trust them, it's gonna hurt. So, you have to trust a lot on the web. You have to trust a lot in the case of a modern distributed application. How hard would it be for Google to remove all mentions, say, let's say Google and Tesla decided to really get into it. How hard would it be for Google to just say, I don't want anyone talking about Tesla today? How would they do that? You know, they've got JavaScript incorporated into most of the web, at least outside of China. And so what would you put in that JavaScript? You just put a little thing that would just traverse the DOM, check the text, do a little substring check, and see if the word Tesla was in any DOM elements. And if it was, what could it do? It could just make the page not load. Or it could just delete those parts of the page that mention Tesla. Or just delete the story or whatever, or substitute Google, I don't know. They could do whatever they wanted because it's their code, they control it, and they can just rewrite the page because that's what you can do with JavaScript. You can rewrite the page. And there's no limit. Is there, oh, I can only see some part of the DOM? No, in general, when you incorporate this JavaScript, it can access all of the DOM. It can do anything to your page. This is a simple consequence of the things you've been doing in this class. You haven't learned about any mechanisms to isolate code because they aren't there. Now, is there work on trying to improve this? Yes, but so if you think people aren't trustworthy, the fact that the web works at all actually means people are, in general, pretty darn trustworthy. I mean, they may have their motivations, but it's really amazing that people don't try screwing each other over more, you know, like why do planes stay in the sky as opposed to someone deciding to, you know, plow them into the ground? You know, why is it when I drive down the road, someone doesn't just turn their car and, you know, knock me off the road? You know, we do all these trust acts all the time, and that's very much true in how the web works. So, front end versus back end. What do I mean by front end versus back end? You know, for so the real work is the back end, the interface is the front end. Before you did meet, you probably saw a bit of model view controller and stuff and things, but it's still all in the same process and stuff. With a web application, you have to separate out what the front end is, the whole interface part, from the back end. Now, can you do real work in the front end? Can you do real work in the front end? Yes, but what's the but? I mean, modern JavaScript's really fast. Modern browsers actually have a lot of computational capabilities. What's the but? Nope, nothing to do with design, maintainability. Don't trust the answers. Because again, it's running on a system you don't trust. You don't know what the heck they're doing. So the correctness of your application cannot depend upon your front end working exactly the way you expect. Because your front end's running who the heck knows where. I mean, maybe the machine's got a memory error and it's just corrupting the code as it runs. Maybe someone's deliberately trying to mess with your application. You cannot trust the front end to do what it's going to do. You hope it's going to work, but the integrity of your application cannot depend upon it working properly. That's the key thing about, when you talk about front ends and back ends, we normally think about, oh, the front end is the pretty part and the back end's the one that does real work. Yes, but it's also, the back end's the part that's trusted and the front end is the part that's untrusted. Now, of course, with modern apps, it's, you know, when you incorporate a YouTube video, what's the front end and what's the back end? I mean, now the back end is actually Google servers providing the YouTube video, and the front end is still the web page. So, modern web apps have many back ends. We used to call these mashups, now this is normal business. So that's this. So if the front end is if the front end is untrusted, why do any computation in the front end? Why not do everything in the back end? Well, one big reason is you lower the load. If you can push it to the front end, you lower the load in the back end. That's nice. But main. The main reason is latency. So this is what you've seen with AJAX applications. You notice when you had to do a real, when we're using persistent nodes versus AJAX nodes. Notice the difference, even when it was running all on your machine, the difference between clicking in a button and having to load a whole new page versus it just updating the page? The updating the page was faster. And if you're doing a lot more interactions, doing more complex interface interactions, it's got to happen right there because otherwise you're having to... When you have to talk to the server and wait for it to come back, you have to incorporate that round trip time. Much of the design of web applications is in how do you mask the latency of the network traffic. Did you have a question?
There's also an example of mobile apps, and you
Oh yeah, that's true. You can have and can have. But so have you all heard of what responsive web design? The idea of responsive web design is you make an interface that scales nicely to different kinds of size pages. So you want, what I mean? Let me save this here first before we do this. So let's go to so here's Bootstrap. So you see this page? So let's see how Bootstrap deals with so you notice how the page changes? As I get bigger, see, watch this. See now, oh, look, a menu appeared at the top. As I made it bigger, and then it kind of spread out. When I made it small, it got rid of it. And in fact, now I just have this menu here. That's a responsive design. It means it detects it how the capabilities of the front end, what it can do, whether it's got touch or not, and whether it how big the screen is, and it changes the layout. How do you do responsive design? Well, you can generally use JavaScript. the JavaScript's using this, and it rewrites the DOM based on what's happening. And if you incorporate toolkits like Bootstrap and stuff, they do this for you. That you just specify the divs, and then it goes and figures out how to do the layout and the fonts and everything to make this work. Again, just using the stuff we've been talking about in this class, but you know, this is a philosophy that's currently fashionable with web design. It used to be you'd make a mobile website, and then you'd make a desktop website. Now they're saying just make a responsive website. Because if you do it right, it'll look good basically everywhere. Depending on how much work you want to do. God, I got a lot of bad pages here. Let me get rid of all these. There. There. Okay. Structured persistence. So, how did you save things? How did you make things persist across program implications? You stuck it in a file. Files are unstructured on modern systems. If you go back to old mainframes, files actually had records and stuff and fields and things, but modern files, they're just byte streams. How you interpret them is up to you. If you want to have fast access to any part, you have to impose that structure, whatever. But so when we say we're using a database, really it's just the reason why I say database is because when you talk about NoSQL versus SQL, SQL databases is more the classic database. They've got tables, got relations, and all those things. But then a lot of the things when we talk about NoSQL databases, they're just key value stores. It's just you got a key, you got a value. So it's kind of like a file system, except they're just sort of random keys. It's not even necessarily hierarchical. The main difference is it's persistence and it's high performance or something. So, why structured versus unstructured? It's nice. Hey, I just want to have an object. I don't have to write my own routine to parse the file and figure out where things are. I just say, here is some structured data. Store it. And then retrieve it. Basically, if you're going to do something other than simple read it in, it's nice to have something that's pre-indexed. So you can find, you know, you want to find that person by their address or their city or their name or their ID or something. Databases are really nice for that. Instead of you having to build a sophisticated data structure to enable you to do all this, which you could do in memory, and then you have to load from disk and parse it and other things, you just have the database and you just do your query directly to it. The other big reason? Concurrency. I can now separate my persistent store from the thing that does the computational heavy lifting of my web server. You know, the thing that actually does my backend, then I have my backend database. My database is doing the storage. And the other part is, you know, it's a separation of concerns. I can split up the pieces. And then I can have these different pieces access it at different times. And I have one part that just has to worry about making sure they don't step on each other's toes. Yes?
If I make it a text file instead of a database, won't I still have concurrency and distribution?
What happens if two processes access the text, try modifying a text file at the same time? No. So if I try writing to a text file multiple times, what's going to happen to that text file? Well, it depends on how you write to the text file. One way to write the text file is you write separate byte ranges. You might say, I'm going to write to you know, one process is going to write to position 500, another one's going to write to position 2000. And so as long as they only write to they write separately, then they won't step on each other. But what happens if the one writing at 500 actually wants to insert things into the file? So it's going to grow the file, but at that position. Now, what was it? Offset 2000 has moved to offset 2100. Oops. So now you have to have something at the top that says, well, where is my data in my file? Where are the offsets? Now you have to constantly update that. You might say, well, I'll just put all of my data, you know, every little piece of data that I might want to access in separate files. No one should ever access a file individually. Okay, fine. Now you have to enforce that no one's going to access the same file at the same time. You have to implement locks. And now you better make sure there's not much contention for that thing because, you know, now your files have to be really small. You find it. Basically, what you're doing then is you start implementing a database badly using files. Once you start having individual elements like records allowing for concurrent access to them, so you're putting in separate files, you're building a database. So just use a database. I would say that's the real thing. Why do you go to a database? It's because you need concurrent access. And that's why websites, you know, that's where you really see, oh, I've got a web server, I need a database, because websites are highly concurrent, because you have to deal with many individuals accessing your website at the same time. And this really comes into factor if I'm going to run multiple web servers that have to coordinate their safe state. Then I want to have that all talking to the same database. Maybe it's a distributed database, but then all the issues of how do I distribute the data is confined to the database, not to the rest of the application. What it is when you deal with the problems of concurrent access to data, you end up building a database of some form. That's what you end up doing. So why reinvent the wheel? That's just me. If there's some reason that, oh, this current one particular database doesn't fit what you want, use a different one. You might say, oh, that database is too slow. Use a different one. There's ones that are very, very fast. In fact, there are, you know. So, like, memcached. A distributed free open source high performance distributed memory object caching system. Generic in nature, but intended for speeding up dynamic web applications by alleviating database load. So, you want something to speed up your database? You use something like this in front of it. You cache the object, you know, the requests. How does something like memcache really fast? Because it runs in RAM. It's in memory. It's just doing accesses, but it kind of acts database-like. If a given component is too slow, use another component. Someone else has had the same problems as you. You say, but I want to write it myself. Don't. You're going to write it badly. Unless you're part of a large team and you've actually evaluated the other options, or unless you're looking to just do something for fun and, you know, just to kind of, well, no, if you're looking to do something for fun, contribute to another existing project. Add feet, you know, extend the code there. Don't just, unless you're trying to learn a language or something. What? Hmm? So the idea of memcache is that you have your database is accessing disk. You're making requests to your database is too slow. So what do? You stick memcache in between your application and your database, and so it goes to memcache, and so it remembers the frequently accessed things, and so it won't have to go to disk because memcache will store it in memory. So it'll reply much faster. Don't think of this as a server. Think of this as you have like 100 servers. You have like 10 servers running your main web server. You have like another 10 servers, you know, you have maybe like 50 servers running your web front end. You maybe have 20 servers running your database, and you stick memcache in between them because your database is getting overloaded. Yeah, if you're running this on one machine, you don't use stuff like this. But again, there's nothing fundamental about something like this. It's just, you know, it's like, oh, I've got some JSON or something. instead of the JSON going, you know, request coming directly from the database, it comes from here. So structured persistence is useful. Structured persistence is something you'll want to do. If you find that the kind of structure, there's many ways of doing structured persistence. We talked about MongoDB. MongoDB is more complicated than some ones. It's not as complicated other ways. If you go to the database class, 3005, it'll talk to you about structured persistence. I mean, fully realize that's databases. And there's a lot of different ways of doing databases, a lot of ways of querying them, a lot of organizing. It's a lot of whole issues. You can learn it there. But safe to say, it's easier to use what they've provided as opposed to building a database from scratch. Databases are complicated because they have to deal with concurrency. Is there a question over here? So we are, I've almost gotten to this. So we got front end, distributed applications, markup and templates. So we've talked about HTML, CSS, you know, those are the two, actually, and Jade. So HTML, CSS. Jade, it's a templating language. Because Jade is used to generate HTML. So why is markup important? So when I talk about markup and templates, I mean, these are examples, but they're not the only ones. I mean, HTML is evolving, CSS is evolving, and there's lots of other markup languages that you could potentially use. I mean, you could say, you know, one way we talk about markup, you could say XML is a kind of thing, but have you all heard of LaTeX? Oh. I'm kind of curious what LaTeX, but this is, that's nice, it comes out first. I was curious whether it would actually say the rubber or something, or it would talk about. I wonder why it's doing that, actually. That's a pretty good thing, considering I'm doing that right now, and it, yeah. For a lot of people, that wouldn't... Because I'm not logged in this browser. Anyway, so the LaTeX project. So this is based on something called Tech. Tech was created by someone called Donald Knuth. Donald Knuth, if you don't know him, let's bring up Donald Knuth. Very famous computer scientist. He wrote The Art of Computer Programming. If you want to learn kind of classic data structures, algorithms, fundamentals of the field, this is one of those book series to write. Now, the funny thing about The Art of Computer Programming is that it has a lot of math in it. And it's also, you know, it's a book and stuff. And Donald Knuth, when he was writing it in the 70s and 80s, what was The Art of Computer Programming? It was... History, it was, started to write the book about compiler in 1962, 60s, you know, so it started in the 60s and the 70s, but anyway, when he started writing this book, he realized all the systems that existed for creating math, for typesetting math, didn't do a good enough job for his math. His math looked ugly. So you know what he decided to do? Make a program for typesetting math. So he took years to make so, let's see. Tech. So if you look at Tech, Tech is the first version was published was typeset using a hot metal type set by a Monotype Corporation typecaster. The whole book had to be typeset again because monotype technology had been largely replaced by photographic techniques, and he found them awful. So he wrote a memo to himself showing the basic feature test. So 78, he did this. And then he published by age. I mean, he basically took years off to public to make a typesetting system. Huh? He created font systems too, Metafont, to be able to describe the fonts. He created his own fonts. He created his own typesetting system. He basically created everything for making his book. Computer scientists still use Tech, but if you use Tech by itself, it's a very low-level markup language for writing. I mean, you're telling exactly how to publish the book. So instead, most people use LaTeX. So instead of saying, instead of defining your vocabulary of how your thing is, this thing provides you like, oh, I want a title. I want a document. Wait, so LaTeX. So here's an example of a LaTeX document. So you will notice some things like it has, starts with a declaration, document class, use package, begin document section. This is LaTeX. It's a markup language. Does it look like HTML? No. It looks completely different from HTML. But it's a markup language. Can you translate from LaTeX to HTML? Oh, yes, you can. And in fact, there are general ways of converting markup, like things like Pandoc. Pandoc, I haven't ever really gotten a chance to use it because I haven't had a good excuse to use it, but it seems like just the coolest thing ever. So, assuming it will load. So again, we're looking for our CDN seems to be slow. But the idea of Pandoc is there's a lot of different markup languages for marking up text. So why not have something that can convert between them? So remember I talked about Markdown? Markdown is a markup language for text. You can use Markdown to mark up things and convert it. Where's another markup language? Oh, look, I'm using a markup language right here. When I generate my wiki entries. Markup is everywhere because in general, when you want to encode things, you have to type it in some way and then it gets converted to something else. And you can say, well, but I like WYSIWYG. I like going into Word and highlighting text and then saying it's bold. Well, you know something, underlying Microsoft Word, there's a markup language. They just hide it from you. Older word processors like WordPerfect would have a mode called show codes, where then you would see the markup. You'd see, oh look, here's where the bold starts, here's where the bold ends. Word, for some reason, still hides this from you. But there's a markup language underneath it. That's for saying how the document's supposed to be rendered. This is a fundamental idea in computer science. It's a fundamental idea for building interfaces. For building not just a static thing that's there, but for building dynamic interfaces, you use a markup. You could say, well, why don't I just build my code? Well, a markup language is a way of programming. Here. You're declaring what something should be. You're not telling it exactly how to do it. It's not procedural. It's not object-oriented. But either it's, you know, specifying constraints on how it is, or you're saying, okay, this is, you know, a headline. That's implicitly a program. You're telling it to render it in a certain way. But it's a way, but you're declaring things as opposed to telling it what to do step by step. I mean, instead of saying, okay, change the font to this and then do this or do this, you're just saying you're writing the program at a higher level. That's what declarative things are. Declarative things are, yeah? Exactly. Jade's a well. So Jade, a template language, is typically a. what is a template language? It's a markup of a markup language. It's meta markup. What is Jade? You're marking up HTML. And HTML is a markup, you know, language for text. What do computer scientists do? You have something, do it. You add another level of indirection. This is a fundamental idea. It's everywhere. And in general, if you can program your task in a declarative language like this, doing something like markup, do it. Because it will result in much less code. Which is, less code is much easier to maintain. Maybe you say, well, maybe you might even have to create your own declarative language for a given task. That's a classic thing in computer science. You create your own programming languages as you go. I mean, what do you do when you made a wiki? They made a language here for markup. When you made your notes thing, you started implementing a markup language for your notes. Why did we do it? For safety reasons and for efficiency reasons. It was easy, you know, it looks better. I mean, there's lots of reasons you do this. You did a little trivial version of a markup language in here. And then you, in effect, you could say the code that was, you're building a template language, but the code that you had. Anyway, so fundamental ideas. Distributed application structure, persistent front, back end, markup templates, trust. Not everything we've covered, but certainly some of the main ones. And anyway, I'll stop there. And we'll continue. I'll try to talk about Web Everywhere on Monday. Thursday last questions, and then we'll have the review session on Friday.